My name is Easton Miles, and I live in Pasadena, California. My wife Camille and I spend many hours on a secluded beach about 45 miles from our home. We traveled there whenever we could. We had found our own little quaint wooden beach overlooking some beautiful rock pools with an open stretch of beach that extended for miles both ways. We talked for hours and found it invigorating spending time away from the bustle of city life. One Saturday, on the 2nd of July, 2016, about 1 p.m., Camille went for a walk to spend some peaceful, alone time on the beach. She was normally gone for about an hour, but on this day, she never returned. I was frantic with worry, not knowing what happened to her. I called the police. A woman by the name of Leah said she had passed a woman that fitted Camille's description, heading in the opposite direction, about a mile away, at about 1:30 p.m. Leah said they had smiled at each other as they walked by. The police combed the beach and surrounding areas in teams for 2 weeks. But Camille was never found. I never left home for 2 months after that. I couldn't come to terms with it. When the love of your life is missing, there is no closure. Even though deep down, I had an undeniable feeling that she was dead. One warm Friday, I decided to revisit our special place. Maybe I'll see her, I thought as I approached our wooden bench. As I was about to sit down, I felt like someone was watching me. I wasn't wrong. I turned around, and Leah was standing about 10 yards away, leaning against a rock. "Leah?" I said, feeling startled.
"Hi, Easton,"
she replied.
"It's so sad about your wife. How long has it been? 2 months now?"
she added, a look of empathy on her pretty face. "Yeah," I said, wondering what she was doing here. "About right."
"You must be lonely and heartbroken,"
she said as she approached me.
"Do you mind if I join you? I mean, I don't want to intrude,"
she added in a gentle voice. The truth was that I wanted time alone, but maybe I needed her gentle presence. Leah was in her late 20s, very beautiful with soft, serene eyes and long, flowing brown hair. "Sure," I answered. "I'd like to just sit quietly, though, if you don't mind."
"I understand completely, Easton,"
she said as she sat next to me. We'd sat there without exchanging a word for about 10 minutes when I felt her place her hand on mine and turn to look at me. "Leah, I don't think this is appropriate," I said as I stood up, shocked and slightly angered.
"Oh, Easton, I'm so, so sorry. I didn't mean to offend you,"
she said, looking sad.
"I thought you may appreciate the comforting touch. Please accept my apologies,"
she pleaded. I felt bad. After all, I was going through a rough time, and she was just being kind. No, Leah. I'm sorry," I said. I guess I'm still very sensitive. What you did was very thoughtful."
"Really?"
she asked, looking for assurance. "Yes, really, Leah," I answered with a gentle smile. "Thank you for your support." We left shortly after that, but when I arrived at my car, I noticed her metallic blue Toyota Yaris parked about 20 yards behind mine. Coincidence? Probably. We both left, but as I was nearing the off-ramp to my home, I spotted her car 3 cars behind me. I felt uneasy, but maybe she lived near me. I visited Camille in my favorite spot on 2 occasions shortly after that, and it was becoming freaky, as on both occasions, Leah arrived a short while after I did. On the first of these 2 visits, Leah had a picnic basket in her hand. She sat next to me quietly and unwrapped a sandwich, handing it to me. It was shredded beef, onion, and baby gherkin with hot English mustard. It was my favorite and something Camille had always made for me. How did you know?" I asked.
"You look like a beef and mustard man,"
she said, smiling. I hadn't eaten properly in months and finished off another 2 sandwiches. On this occasion, she held my hand and put her head on my shoulder. I was uncomfortable, but I didn't want to offend her kind gesture. A week later, I visited the old wooden bench again. This time, when I arrived, I didn't see Leah's car, but she was lying on the bench, the wind lifting her braided white skirt, revealing way more than I should have been seeing. She appeared to be asleep. I gently called her name, moving away from the view. She stretched out and sat up.
"Oh, Easton,"
she said, acting surprised.
"I must have fallen asleep."
"Hi, Leah," I said. She was looking at me with seductive eyes.
Do you ever?
She trailed off. Do I ever what? I asked.
You know. Do you ever miss it?
She asked, her eyes drawing me in. You mean sex, Leah? I asked matter-of-factly. The truth was, I was becoming aroused, but I couldn't allow this.
Oh, Easton, do me here. Do me now.
She said, breathing heavily. Feeling vulnerable, the temptation to do the wrong thing was strong, but I stormed off.
This is going too far, Leah.
I shouted as I left.
Stay away from me.
All I could hear was,
I'm so sorry, Easton. Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought you may find it comforting. Please forgive me.
Comforting? This was getting too close for comfort. Reaching my car hurriedly, I drove off without looking back, thinking it was the last time I would ever see Leah again. I was wrong. Arriving home from work the following day, Leah's Toyota Yaris was parked outside. What the hell is she doing here? I thought. How does she know where I live? To top it all, she was nowhere to be seen. The porch light went on and the front door opened. Leah was standing in the doorway. I quickly approached her.
I thought I'd surprise you, Easton.
She said with a giggle that was unbefitting. How the hell did you get into my house, Leah? I demanded angrily.
Please don't anger me, Easton.
She said, trying to look cute. Where did you get the keys to my house from? I shouted aggressively.
You know what your problem is, Easton.
She started with her back to me. I saw the gun in her hand as she turned to face me.
You don't appreciate me.
Her tone had changed.
Sit down,
she said firmly, pushing me onto the couch. The gun was pointed directly at me, and I was afraid.
You don't remember me, do you?
She asked.
Leah Williams, quiet, little Leah Williams, the school librarian, the nerd.
Suddenly, I recalled who she was.
I watched you every day. We were made for each other. But then you choose Camellia? Now we can be together, Easton. Finally, I get the love of my life.
Leah, what happened to Camilla? I asked, the picture emerging.
Promise you'll love me forever, Easton. And I'll put the gun away.
She said, tears now welling up in her eyes. Camilla, I started, and then I saw Camilla's keys hooked onto Leah's belt. She said in a sick, distorted way.
I buried her next to a palm tree in a grove. I made it quick for her. You don't have to worry about her anymore, Easton. It's time for us now.
Oh, God. No. I heard myself cry out from my gut. As she lowered the gun, I saw my opportunity, but a fraction away from her, a shot deafened me. She had shot herself up through the mouth, and there was blood everywhere. I don't remember calling the police, but they arrived. Camilla's body was found 2 days later in a bad state of decay. My mental health suffered intensely, and I couldn't talk for 3 months. I have been going for trauma counseling for more than a year now. I don't think my life will ever return to normal again.
My name's Emmett Tanner, and I'm now 43 years old. I joined the U.S. Marines at a young age and excelled in self-defense as a sniper. Due to my skills, I was chosen to be part of an elite, top-secret group for the security of various members of the state under then-President George H.W. Bush from January 1990 to November 1992. I received the rank of second lieutenant. My job mainly involves surveillance from buildings with a rifle, using high-tech sights and a pair of telescopic binoculars. During my service, I'd had to take two people out who both had attempted to assassinate two high-ranking officials. I enjoyed that job. It gave me a great thrill knowing that I had the lives of many in my hands, and my observation and sighting skills became second nature to me. I served for another 9 years after that until 2001. What I didn't realize at the time was that my skills would become an obsession. Today is the 30th of April 2007, and I'm in jail for life. So to me, it's just another day. During my stint in the Marines, I was stationed in Houston. Our sleeping quarters consisted of two 10-story buildings directly opposite one another, one for males, and the other building quarters for female officers. I was on the 10th floor, in a room of my own on a corner of the building facing the women's dwelling. My night vision binoculars were so powerful that I could see a dime on the pavement 10 floors below. But I wasn't interested in looking at dimes. There were four women officers whom I found extremely enticing, and in a monochrome green night after night, I watched them undress and watch TV in skimpy nighties. One stood out from the rest. Captain Harlow Delaney was the sexiest of them all. On hot summer nights, she would sit in only her underwear and brush her beautiful long auburn hair, and she always came out of her shower into her living room completely naked, with a towel wrapped around her head. She never bothered to draw her curtains as nobody could see anything from our building, 150 yards away, except someone spying on her with a pair of binoculars. Someone like me. I didn't realize just how sick I was then, and never considered myself a stalker, but this went on for 2 years. After so much time spent taking in her beauty, I wanted to have sex with Captain Delaney. One day, while everyone was going about their duties at our base camp about 2 miles away, I climbed the stairs in the woman's dorm, red roses in hand, and within seconds, had Miss Delaney's apartment door open. I inhaled her scent as I sprinkled rose petals all over her bed and trailed them to her door. I found some lipstick and wrote on her bathroom window, "You're just so hot, Captain Harlow Delaney." Then I took out a notepad and wrote her a letter. "I watch you every night, and you really turn me on. I know you want me. You just don't know how much you want me yet." I placed it on her coffee table. She had left her cell phone in her room, and so I took down her number. That evening, I waited with bated breath for her to come home. She arrived at around 6 p.m., and I could see the shock on her face when she came into vision. No night sights needed. As I looked through the binoculars, she appeared to be staring straight at me. "Shit!" I cursed as I crouched down. Had she seen me? I thought as my heart raced. She couldn't have, I convinced myself. I had voice pitch lowering software on my cell. I activated it and then called her. "Captain Delaney," she answered, sounding shaken. "I hope you like your surprise, Lieutenant," I said, my two tone octaves lower. "Who the hell are you?" she shouted back. "A secret admirer, baby. Don't be angry. By the way, your scent fills your place, and it drives me wild," I responded. "Whoever you are, you're toast, you freak. I'm calling security," she said angrily and firmly. "Ah, gee, why'd you want to do that?" I asked. "Aren't you just touched that you have someone who can't resist you?" She quickly cut me off. I took another peek through the binoculars, and within 2 minutes, two male Marines and a fellow female officer had entered her apartment. Suddenly, someone knocked on my door. "Who the hell can that be?" I questioned. I hastily packed away my binoculars, expecting the worst. "Hey, Emmett, buddy," came the voice with a friendly smile as I opened the door. It was Arlo from down the hall. "Hey, Arlo, what's up, bud?" I asked casually. I could see he wanted to come in, but I stood holding the door. "Just wanted to return your book, Emmett," he said, passing me my book called Criminals and Justice. "Some badass people in there," he said, "particularly the stalkers," he added. "Thank goodness they're all caught. They always get caught. Bastards," he said as he turned to leave. "Yeah, bastards," I added. "See you around, bud." Sometimes you feel like you've been hit with a sledgehammer, and this was one of those times. The next morning before roll call at 8 a.m., I waited to one side until I spotted Captain Delaney. She was walking alone, so I approached her and saluted her. "Morning, Captain," I said smartly. "Morning, Lieutenant," she said with a smile, but she looked troubled. "What can I do for you, Emmett?" she asked. "I just wanted to say hi, Captain. You're looking very smart today," I quipped. "Thank you, Emmett," she said, looking towards the ground. "Is something wrong, ma'am?" I asked. "Some madman went into my room yesterday and spread rose petals all over the place. The intruder also wrote some sick, perverted letter and smeared some filth on my bathroom mirror with lipstick." "That's dreadful, ma'am. Some real sickos on the prowl," I said, acting concerned. "If there's anything I can do..." I started. "Thank you, Emmett," she answered, "but I have some people on the case." Captain Delaney had referred to me as a madman and a pervert. I didn't take kindly to that at all. I smiled, saluted her, and lined up for roll call. As the day drew to a close, I waited behind a wall near the entrance to the ladies' apartment building and came out into the open as Captain Delaney arrived. It was already 7:15 p.m., and she was startled at seeing me. "Emmett, what are you doing here?" she asked. Just making sure you get home safely, Captain, and that you don't have a repeat of yesterday, I responded in a concerned tone. That's very kind of you, Emmett, but I've already told you I have people on the case, she said rather firmly. I was offended. A madman? A pervert? And now rejection of my offer to help? I went upstairs to my room and locked the door. I was about to teach Captain Harlow Delaney a lesson. I removed my sniper rifle from its case and assembled it together with its night sight and silencer. I very quickly had her in my crosshairs, but then she moved out of sight. Then I saw Major Ann Taylor appear. They were close friends. They began chatting as I was becoming impatient. I had an opportunity as my crosshair centered on Captain Delaney's forehead. Squeeze. I pulled the trigger. Simultaneously, Captain Delaney moved, and the bullet struck Major Taylor in her chest, killing her instantly. I think everyone in the area heard Captain Delaney scream. Damn, I said under my breath. Shit! Forensic experts quickly traced the trajectory of the bullet to my room. By the next morning, after checking that my rifle had been fired only 10 hours earlier, I was arrested and sentenced to life imprisonment. I miss those exciting days. Perhaps I'll be out soon for good behavior. My name is Hector Abbott, and I live on the second floor of an old apartment block in Green Street, Soho in downtown New York. I retired 2 years ago, and I'm now 62. I was a paratrooper in the military and keep myself fit by working out every day. I'm what one might classify as an ardent observer. I sit on my balcony and it's like watching TV. In fact, I don't own a TV. The daily activities on Green Street keep me entertained. The other day, while purchasing some fresh bread rolls from Allison's Bakery, a block away on the opposite side of Green Street, I met the lovely young lady who owns and runs the small bakery carrying her name. The scent of freshly baked items wafted through the shop. I had seen her place, but had never gone inside. I don't miss much, and noticed a guy of around 30 doing window shopping outside the bakery, except there wasn't much in the window area but a small price list. He had blonde hair combed to one side, and a pair of faded blue jeans and a black leather jacket on. Beautiful little business you have here, I remarked, keeping an eye on the tall, slender guy at the window. Why, thank you, sir. Are you from around here? Allison asked. Yeah, the name's Hector Abbott, and I live in an apartment a block away, I responded, noticing the guy outside was staring at Allison. He quickly looked away when I turned to face him. Well, because you're a new customer, you can have the bread rolls on the house, Mr. Abbott, Allison offered kindly with a friendly and warm smile. That's very kind of you, Allison. I'll be sure to buy all my baked goodies from you from now on, I responded cheerfully. Oh, wonderful. Thank you, sir, she added all bright-eyed. I gave her a warm smile, but as I turned to leave, I noticed that guy who had been outside was now on the side of the street that I lived on, but still opposite the bakery. I crossed the road at an angle to walk back to my apartment, but kept a close vigil on him out of the corner of my eye. As I arrived at my apartment block, I saw him head back towards Allison's bakery. I had a gut feeling that something was amiss with this guy, so I began walking back towards him. As he saw me, he turned, pulled the hood of his black jacket over his head, and walked away swiftly. I stood there for 10 minutes to make sure that he never came back. Allison was kind and a friendly young lady, and I cared about her safety. The next morning, I rose at my normal time of 4:30 a.m., made a cup of coffee, and, lighting a smoke, went to sit on my balcony. At about 5:30 a.m., I saw the same guy dressed the same about 2 blocks away on the bakery side of the road. Leaning against a wall with one leg propped up against it, he lit one cigarette after another, the whole while gazing around suspiciously. I knew he was waiting for Allison. I don't know how, but I just knew it. At around 6:30 a.m., I saw Allison in the distance, climbing off a bus and heading to her shop. The guy stood up straight and took out a book, pretending to read it. As Allison neared him, he lowered the book and remarked, "Beautiful morning for a beautiful lady." Being polite, Allison responded with dignity, "Thanks for the compliment, and what's your name?" "You can call me Frank, Allison," he said. "Mind if I walk you to the bakery?" She felt awkward as he was a stranger. "Can't be careful enough in this part of town. There's some real wackos around." "Well, okay then," she replied so as not to offend him. As they walked, she felt uneasy, as Frank kept eyeing her all over. When they reached the bakery, she said politely, "Thank you, Frank. You have a good day now." "Oh, I will, Allison. It started off well just walking next to you," he replied with a smirk before walking away. I put on some decent clothes and headed for Allison's bakery. As I did so, I thought I saw the guy suddenly sneak into the alley about 30 yards away. "Is that guy harassing you, Allison?" I asked, entering the shop. "He wanted to walk me to the bakery. He said there's a lot of wackos around." I thought it was harmless enough, but he kept on staring at me. "I'll keep an eye on him for you. I don't trust him," I replied. "He made me feel very uneasy, Mr. Abbott. Said his name was Frank." "Don't fret, Allison. I got you covered," I said as I turned to leave. "Thank you, Mr. Abbott. I would appreciate it," she smiled. Sitting on my balcony close to Allison's 5 p.m. closing time, I noticed Frank crossing the road with his jacket hood on, but he headed towards the same alley I had seen him move into earlier. After locking up, as Allison moved to pass the alley, Frank stepped out, startling her. "You gave me a fright, Frank," she said as her palms became sweaty. "Ah, Allison, sorry about that, but remember, I'm not one of the wackos around here," he said with wide eyes and a snicker. "I'll walk you to your bus ride," he added. This was becoming too much. "I really don't need escorting, Frank, and I'd appreciate it if you left me the hell alone," she retorted angrily. "She doesn't recognize me or remember me," he thought as he walked away. I quickly moved downstairs. After Allison had walked about 100 yards, Frank began following her. I kept my distance and followed without being seen. As Allison's bus departed, she noticed Frank standing with his arms folded. He quickly pointed at her with a sick smile on his face, and then gestured with the peace sign. I approached him openly, but when he saw me, he rapidly made his way through the heavy traffic, and I lost him. At least Allison was on her way home safely. Frank continued his antics for another 4 days. I just couldn't pin him down, and Allison was a nervous wreck. We reported his activity to the police. I never oversleep, but the next morning I woke up with a startle. It was 7:30 a.m. I quickly moved to my balcony viewpoint. Allison's bakery was still closed, and neither her nor Frank were anywhere to be seen. I knew something was wrong. I got dressed quickly, skipped coffee, and went straight to the bakery. I tried the door. It wasn't locked, which was a big sign that something was seriously wrong. I entered quietly and looked around. No sign of anyone. Allison had a small kitchen at the back of her shop where she made tea and took her lunch breaks. I opened the door slowly and will never forget that sight. Allison was tied up and gagged. Her feet and hands were also tied together, and her eyes were wide with fear. She never made a sound, but moved her head and eyes as though trying to let me know that Frank was here too. Suddenly, I felt his presence. I turned around as he closed the door while facing us. He had a large butcher's knife in his right hand. "Old man," he said aggressively, "didn't your mom ever teach you to mind your own business?" he grunted as he began moving the knife between hands. I took the deceptive, helpless Tai Chi stance, ready to use my combat skills. "Ha ha, you're pathetic, old man," he laughed. "You look like an idiot." Allison was writhing and moaning with the gag in her mouth. Frank managed to move about 3 inches closer, and then he didn't have time to know what hit him. In a split second, the knife went flying. I busted his arm and tripped him over backwards with 1 foot behind his. It only took 15 seconds and I'd beaten him senseless. He was bleeding from mouth, eyes, and nose. Writhing and crying out in agony, I said to him, "That'll teach you not to mess with a 62-year-old paratrooper, you piece of shit." Then I kicked him in the head, and he was out for the count. I removed Allison's gag and untied her. She gasped for air, but eventually her breathing steadied. Other than a few bruises from the tight ropes, she was unharmed. "Thank you, Mr. Abbott," she said repeatedly. "Where'd you learn to fight like that?" she asked. I just smiled. "Age is just a number, my friend. Let's call the cops." The police arrived promptly, and after questioning us, they had to carry the unconscious Frank to their van. Looking at me with my short gray hair, the two policemen couldn't believe that I was the one who had reduced a man much younger than myself to an unconscious mess on the floor. I checked in on Allison regularly after that, and we became close friends. A 62-year-old and a 25-year-old. Never again would Frank be stalking her. He was charged with severe harassment and attempted murder. Despite the event being extremely traumatic for Allison, news of the incident spread quickly and gained her twice as many customers. I still sit and observe from my viewpoint. When Frank Hansen was questioned by the police, they found out that he and Allison had been at school together. He confessed at being grossly overweight as a scholar, and despite Allison having quite a few boyfriends, she always rejected his advances. He held a grudge against her for 10 years, vowing that one day he would win her over. He worked out regularly and finally got the physique he thought would impress her. When she showed no interest in him yet again and didn't even recognize him, it was a snapping point for him. Unfortunately for him, his plan of raping and murdering Allison was foiled by a 62-year-old paratrooper.